94.1 in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 in Fresno.
Good morning. It's Monday, April 9th, 2012. Welcome to KPFA's locally produced morning program, The Morning Mix. I'm Adrienne Lobby, together with Anthony Fest.
Good morning, Adrienne.
Good morning, Anthony. Tomorrow, California's third parties will be in court to challenge Prop 14, the so-called Top 2 law. This law makes November's election into contests between the top two contenders in each race, obliterating any third-party challengers. Today, we have representatives of three long-standing California third parties in our studio to talk about what's at stake for voters in this important case. But first, the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with news headlines for Monday, April 9th. Two white Oklahoma men accused in a deadly shooting rampage in a black Tulsa neighborhood were formally charged with murder and other counts this morning. Alvin Watts and Jake England appeared via closed-circuit television from jail for their first court appearance. They're charged in Friday's early morning shooting deaths of three African-Americans in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the wounding of two others. James Finch, the head of the FBI's Oklahoma office, said it was too soon to identify the shootings as a hate crime.
It is very premature to talk about hate crimes. We have yet to analyze all the information to understand the motivations of the subjects in this case.
But the only African-American member of the Tulsa City Council, Jack Henderson, said it certainly appeared the shooting rampage was racially motivated.
I think that somebody that committed these crimes were very upset with black people. That person happened to be a white person. The people that they happened to kill and shoot were black people.
The shootings took place on the anniversary of the death of 19-year-old England's father, who was killed by an African-American man 2 years ago. England marked the anniversary with a racial slur on his Facebook page. England had also lost his girlfriend and mother of his infant in January to suicide. UC Berkeley campus activists plan a rally this morning on Sproul Plaza to demand the Alameda County District Attorney drop criminal misdemeanor charges against 13 people who took part in a November Occupy Cal protest. 12 of those charged have received stay-away orders barring them from the campus except to attend classes or go to work. A few of the orders have been revoked, but the majority remain in place. Some of the protesters were beaten by police. All are charged with at least one count of obstructing a thoroughfare and resisting, obstructing, or delaying a peace officer. One is also charged with misdemeanor battery on an officer. The UC Berkeley chancellor has not taken a public position on the criminal prosecutions, which some protesters say would not be proceeding without his consent. This morning's rally takes place at 11 a.m. on Sproul Plaza. Trustees at Santa Monica College voted unanimously to postpone implementation of the controversial two-tier fee system known as Contract Ed. The vote came 3 days after campus police pepper sprayed students trying to force their way into an earlier trustees meeting discussing the issue. Margot Paez filed this report from Santa Monica.
Santa Monica College Board of Trustees President Chui Sang announced to a nearly 400-member crowd of students, faculty, staff, activists, community members, and press that the board would postpone implementation of a new two-tier tuition system to allow for discussion among the members of the college community. The board unanimously approved the motion.
As the president of this college, I'm recommending to the board today to postpone the implementation of the college's self-funded contract education pilot program. A solution to that effect is provided. I hope we can make use of this time during this pause to gather more input from the college community.
According to the college's student newspaper, the two-tier fee system would allow students access to courses such as math and English for the summer and winter sessions only. However, some worry that only wealthy students will have access to these courses, excluding the majority of students who attend Santa Monica College. Tomas Morales, a student at the college, says her father, who cleans floors for a living, sees the importance of a good education, but cannot afford the raised fees.
Because he's taught so much about education and go get your
a certificate and go get your PhD because that's what we need. You're taking away my education, and if you pass contract ed, you're taking my future away.
In Los Angeles, I'm Margot Paez, Pacifica Radio, KPFK.
The Sacramento Bee reports Governor Jerry Brown has recorded a robocall urging Californians to sign a petition they'll receive in the mail to qualify a compromise tax initiative for the November ballot. The paper reports the California Democratic Party paid for the call and said it was sent to more than 1 million households considered likely to sign the petition. It needs more than 800,000 signatures. The measure would raise the sales tax by a quarter cent and raise income tax on the wealthiest Californians. The violence in Syria spilled across two borders today into Lebanon and Turkey. A TV cameraman on the Lebanese side of the border was killed by gunfire from a nearby Syrian village. At least five people in a refugee camp in Turkey were wounded by bullets that authorities say were fired across the border by Syrian forces. The Syrians were believed to be firing at rebels who had tried to escape to the refugee camp after ambushing a military checkpoint. Under the terms of an international deal, Syrian troops were supposed to pull out of population centers by tomorrow morning. But the government yesterday introduced a new demand saying it cannot withdraw without written guarantees from opposition fighters that they will lay down their arms. Syria's main rebel group rejected the government demand. Human Rights Watch says Syrian forces summarily executed more than 100 people, most of them civilians. The report cites several mass executions in the provinces of Homs and Idlib. The U.S. Navy has announced the deployment of a second aircraft carrier to the Persian Gulf region amid rising tensions with Iran over its disputed nuclear program. The deployment of the nuclear-powered USS Enterprise, along with the Abraham Lincoln Carrier Strike Group, marks only the fourth time in the past decade the Navy has had two aircraft carriers operating at the same time in the Persian Gulf and Arabian Sea. The federal government is suing anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan, who hasn't paid her federal taxes in 8 years. Sheehan's son, Casey, was killed in Iraq. Sheehan says that war was illegal and immoral, and if the federal government could give her her son back, she would pay her taxes. Next week, the Internal Revenue Service will ask a Sacramento federal judge to compel Sheehan to give information, presumably so it can seize her assets to satisfy the tax bill. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, sunny, highs in the 60s to lower 70s. Tomorrow and Wednesday, rain is back in the forecast. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny, highs 82 to 88 degrees. You can hear expanded versions of our local news reports at PacificaEveningNews.org. I'll have more news at 10 on letters and politics. Be sure to join us at 6 for the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Eileen Alfandary.
Today, we are talking to California's third parties about their challenge to Proposition 14. This is the proposition that created the new statewide top two electoral system. People as different on the political spectrum as Ralph Nader and Meg Whitman oppose this system, and we'll be telling you why. We're also going to tackle something most of us don't think about until we literally have no choice, end-of-life issues. Longtime hospice nurse Elaine McGee will be in and taking your calls. And last week, the Center for Biological Diversity challenged the Obama administration to save the oceans before it's too late. We'll talk to wildlife biologist and attorney Emily Jeffers about why the center believes this crisis demands immediate attention and the international strategy that could lead us back from the brink. But we begin with the third-party challenge to California's top two law. Now, our primary election will be held on June 5th, less than 2 months from now, and this year's election will be very different than in the previous years. Owing to Proposition 14, a ballot measure that was passed 2 years ago, California is scheduled to deploy a new system where all candidates for a given office will appear on one ballot. However, representatives from several third parties are going to trip to court to challenge the law. Anthony.
Under the new system, instead of a separate primary ballot for each party, all candidates for state and congressional office will be listed on the same ballot, and every voter can choose from among all those candidates. The top two finishers in the June election, regardless of their party affiliation, will then appear on the November general election ballot, essentially making November a runoff election. This is due to Prop 14, the measure that passed in June of 2010. It's informally called the top two law. The Green, Peace and Freedom, and Libertarian parties say the measure is unconstitutional. Last November, they filed a suit to block it, and there will be a hearing in the case tomorrow morning in Alameda County Superior Court, 1221 Oak Street in Oakland. Joining us this morning to discuss the top two law and the challenges to it are representatives of the three parties that filed suit. Marsha Feinland is with the Peace and Freedom Party. She's run for the U.S. Senate representing Peace and Freedom and plans to do so again. Welcome, Marsha.
Good morning.
Mike Rubin is with the Green Party, and along with Marsha, he's also an individual plaintiff in the lawsuit. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Thank you for having me.
And with us on the phone is Richard Winger. Richard is with the Libertarian Party. He's also the editor of the website Ballot Access News. Good to have you with us, Richard.
Thank you very much.
And let's begin with Marsha. Tell us in a nutshell why you're challenging this measure and what legal grounds.
Well, this measure is very anti-democratic. And we feel that it doesn't give voters a real choice. Now, the open primary top two initiative was put forward as being something that gives voters more choices. But actually, in November, when most people vote, they'll have very little choice because only the top two vote getters in the primary will be able to make the ballot. And those top two vote getters might not be even from two different parties. They might be very, very similar. It's also possible that neither of the top two vote getters get anywhere close to a majority. So it's not even both of them put together. For instance, in the coming Senate race, there are 24 candidates. So it's very possible for each of the top two to get a very low percentage, although that's very doubtful since Dianne Feinstein is one of them. But if we're going to have a challenge to the powers that be, we've got to be able to make real choices, and we can't do that with this election.
So whether or not it's good policy, on what grounds do you say it's unconstitutional?
It's unconstitutional because the parties do not get to pick their candidates. And it's not just the parties. It's the voters in the parties that don't get to pick their candidates. In fact, we're forced into a position in which the parties pick their candidates. The parties are able to make endorsements in the primary instead of leaving it up to the voters. There are supposed to be primaries in which the voters in the parties pick their candidate. Those candidates go to the election. That's not what's happening.
Okay, let's turn now to Mike Rubin with the Green Party. Now, Prop 14 passed 2 years ago with just under 54% statewide. Not an overwhelming mandate, but a majority. And it also won a majority in all but three of the state's 58 counties. So why contest the decision of the voters? And do you think the court might be reluctant to set aside something which the voters passed?
Well, it's possible that the courts might be reluctant. But I will tell you that the people, Proposition 14 passed because people are disgusted particularly the state legislature. And unfortunately, the remedy that was proposed by Proposition 14 for the problems of the state legislature are not responsive to the actual problems in the state legislature, which is that the state legislature is responsible to the 1% and not the 99%. So Proposition 14 was presented as a false solution to partisan gridlock and all that kind of stuff. But the reality is that it's going to do nothing about the problems in the legislature.
Let's turn now to Richard Winger. As a libertarian, Richard, do you concur with Marsha's and Mike's points, or is your reasoning somewhat different?
It's the same, and you asked about constitutionality. The U.S. Supreme Court said in 1986, in a case called Monroe versus Socialist Workers Party, that was from Washington State, that there is no constitutional distinction between a petition method to show a modicum of support worthy of getting a candidate on the November ballot versus a prior vote test. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court had already said that petition requirements for a candidate to get on the general election ballot cannot exceed 5%. Applying the logic of that decision, this system is unconstitutional because it requires a candidate who wants to get on the election ballot itself, which is November, a showing of approximately 30%. Typically, if you look back at primaries in California and many states where all the voters could choose from all the candidates, the second place person typically gets 30%. That's what you need to be in the top two on the average. So that's the basis for the claim. It's about voting rights. The Supreme Court has said every voter has a right to vote for the candidate he or she desires.
So you'll be citing that case when you make your arguments before the Superior Court down the road.
Yes, and I got to say, when this topic was introduced just now, the introducer mentioned the November election as a runoff. That is not accurate. It sounds pedantic, but it's important. Since the 19th century, Congress has told the states to have their congressional and presidential elections in November. And if they want to ensure that the winner got 50%, they have to hold a runoff after that. There's two states that do that, Georgia and Louisiana. They have it in December. So by federal law, whatever California does in June is not the election, because that would be illegal.
Now, as well as being active in the Libertarian Party, you're also the editor of Ballot Access News. So tell us, as someone who follows voting laws around the U.S., are there counterparts to Prop 14 in effect elsewhere in the U.S., and what's the outcome been from those?
That's a very good question. Louisiana has used the system for 35 years, and Washington State has used it for 4 years. There was just a study that came out in the California Journal of Politics and Policy called The Top Two Primary, What Can California Learn from Washington? And the author was the witness for the state of Washington. In fact, in court, in a Washington state case, he was on the state side. But he's a political scientist. He wrote a fair report. The abstract says, the partisan structure of Washington's legislature appears unaltered by the new primary system. In other words, the whole reason this thing was sold to us is it supposedly would make the Washington, well, the legislature behave better. And this study says, after 4 years, it hasn't worked. It says, the aggregate of all this did not add up to a legislature that looked different or functioned differently from the legislature elected under a partisan primary. He's not the only political scientist that said that. Boris Schorr and Seth Masket looked at partisanship and polarization in state legislatures, and they agreed California had the most polarized legislature. But, and this study goes back 15 years, they said Washington State had the second most polarized legislature. And during most of those 15 years, Washington had either a top two primary or a blanket primary.
So, Marcia, this is Adrienne Lobby. When I'm up in the North Bay, which is pretty Democratic, and what I've seen over and over again is in the general election, we've got a Democrat who's going to win and a Republican who doesn't have a chance. So to me, this sounded pretty good. You're going to have two Democrats who have different points of views, one maybe more to the left than the other, and I'll get a chance to maybe put my guy or my gal in. What's wrong with this thinking?
Well, you're making the assumption that the two Democrats might have two different points of view. In fact, if you'd looked at the primary results in the last presidential election, if we had had the top two primary, we would have had Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And we're now finding out that they don't have two different points of views. So therefore, the voters have no choice at all. I think it's really important to open the debate and open the process to people who can really pose an alternative. And Richard said that this proposition was sold to us, I want to emphasize sold. The elections are pretty much sold. They're not really chosen. People there's so much advertising and there's so much money at elections, and what happens with Proposition 14 and this type of primary is that there's even more money required because people need to raise the money both for the primary and for the general election. So it may, the appearance might be sold to you that you have two different candidates, but actually you may end up with two very the same candidates.
And it's 8:20 on the KPFA Morning Mix. We're talking about Proposition 14, the top two primary law, and the upcoming court challenge to it. I'm Anthony Fest with Adrian Lobby. Let's turn to Mike Rubin now as we begin to wrap up this segment. By the way, Prop 14 applies to statewide office and the U.S. House and Senate seats. It does not apply to the presidential race. But Mike Rubin from the Green Party, let's go back and take a look at the history of Prop 14. It was placed on the ballot not by the voter petition process, but by a vote of the legislature. The bill that placed it on the ballot was written by Republican Senator Abel Maldonado. It passed both houses by better than 2-1 margin and also had the support of Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. For a measure that was promoted as taking power away from the party apparatus, it had wide support from Democratic and Republican politicians. But what's the motivation, do you think? If it was all about excluding third parties haven't really made much of a dent in state politics anyway as far as winning office. So what's going on behind this?
Well, I think there's a couple of things to say. One is that the fact that the legislature passed this was a payoff to Abel Maldonado for his vote on the budget. It was his price to pass the budget. They needed a few Republican votes for the budget, and his price was Proposition 14. That's the first thing to say. The second thing is that the purpose of Proposition 14 was not really to harm third parties. I don't know that, but that's not the primary thing. The primary thing was it was sold as a way of getting more, quote, more moderate candidates. That was the so-called selling point, and it goes back to this thing about partisanship and gridlock and all that stuff. And I think that the problem that we have in California is that we have too many moderate candidates, not enough moderate candidates.
And that should be the decision of the voters, not the politicians
absolutely.
Who are already in office. Okay, Marsha Feinland with the Peace and Freedom Party, Mike Rubin with the Green Party, Richard Winger with the Libertarian Party. Thanks for joining us. And Marsha, you have an announcement.
Yeah, I think it's really important for people to go to the court tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock at 1221 Oak Street. But also, the case has been continued twice, so it's very important to go to the website to make sure that it's still on schedule. The website is restorevoterchoice.org.
Okay, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
America, take a good look at your beloved candidates. They're nothing but hideous space reptiles. It's true. We are aliens. But what are you going to do about it? It's a two-party system. You have to vote for one of us.
He's right. This is a two-party system.
Well, I believe I'll vote for a third-party candidate.
Go ahead. Throw your vote away.
Last Thursday, the Connecticut State Senate passed a bill to repeal the death penalty there. The measure now goes to the State House of Representatives. Governor Danielle Malloy says he'll sign a repeal if it reaches his desk. Radio commentator and Pennsylvania prison inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal says the recent flurry of death penalty repeal legislation around the country is motivated not entirely by human rights concerns, but also by financial factors.
Death penalty dies in Connecticut. Several days ago, weeks in fact, I wrote a brief message to brothers and sisters on death row here in Pennsylvania. I told them, among other things, that the death penalty was dying, due in large part to its crippling costs. Just a few days ago, the General Assembly of Connecticut passed a bill repealing its death penalty statutes, calling instead for life without parole. The serious fiscal problems facing states are forcing them to count dollars and cents, and under that math, it simply doesn't add up. Given appeals and the demanding complexity of capital case briefs, states must decide substance over symbol. Must they spend $1 million or more seeking death or a few hundred thousand in life prison terms? The 2008 financial debacle did far more than hurt a nation of mortgage owners. Many states unwisely invested in these mortgage-based securities, and they too took a bath in red ink when they went south. States lost tens of millions in bad investments, and their budgets took a beating. They've got to cut, and cut big. And the multi-million dollar death row units are beginning to look like lamb to a lion. New Jersey did it several years ago. Maryland came close. Now Connecticut has cut its ties to death row. For other states, it's only a matter of time and money. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
This is Adrienne Lobby again. You're listening to The Morning Mix on KPFA. It's 8:25. I recently lost a roommate to a rare disease, and in the process of caregiving, I realized again how difficult and fascinating it is to stand with someone who's in the terminal stage of a disease. I've asked longtime hospice nurse Elaine McGee to come in and take questioners from our listener, not questioners, but questions from our listeners who are facing death or caregiving for someone who is. Thank you for coming in, Elaine.
Thank you for having me.
So, Elaine, 10 months ago, my roommate was told she had a rare disease with no cure. That statement, it was like a starting gun. The race was on. She had to try to understand a disease that her doctors had barely heard of, cope with some extreme and bizarre symptoms, and plot a course to stay alive as long as she could. She'd lost the ability to drive and her source of income. Her support network was small, and some of the relationships, including the one with me, just weren't all that great. We were all shocked, and seriously, we didn't have a clue about how to prioritize. We did take care of the advanced directive in the first month, and that seemed to be a good idea. So why don't we start with that? Tell us, what is an advanced directive, why, who should have them, and why?
An advanced directive is a general term for a lot of different things that document and can make legal what you want done at end of life, what kind of interventions you want, which means do you want to be on life support? Would you want a feeding tube if you couldn't swallow? The different kind of medical things that could be done to prolong your life as long as possible. It also can say who you want to make decisions for you when you can't make them for yourself, medical decisions, and then also who could have access to your finances to pay your bills if you were unable to and make decisions about how your money could be spent.
So you should do this like 2 minutes before you die, right?
That would not be uncommon, but that causes a lot of difficulties and tension. Actually, I think everyone should do it at their majority, that's making their own decisions, an emancipated minor, but anyone over 18, because you never know what's going to happen. And having something in place takes care of everybody around you and yourself so that you have what you want to have happen, have the best likelihood of actually happening.
So for us, that was really good because the tensions between the caregivers trying to figure out what she wanted was like one of the main conversations we had to have. And we all wanted what she wanted. But we didn't really always know. I think there's other things that people might be interested in talking about other than the advanced directives. Is that so?
Yes. There's different ways to look at death. Some people look at it and experience it as a physical event, and all their energy is tied up in the physical event, staying alive as long as possible and treating their symptoms, whatever they are. Other people might experience it, whether or not they could talk about it, as a social or a spiritual event, that they're ending their relationships with people, they're having another round of thinking, what is life all about? Is there something after death? What's the meaning of everything, me and my life? And there's a spectrum between those two things. And the most meaningful lives are the ones where people have had a chance to talk about that and what they think about that with people around them.
So in our relationships, one of the things that came up was this certain sense of urgency, you know, so much to do, so much to think about. And then the relationships were not always so great. And it's like, well, I can't talk to you about what I just felt about what you just said and go over that because, my goodness, you're dying. And I'm supposed to be, like, really good right now, really the angel. Does this come up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, death trumps everything else, you know. Sometimes the looming death trumps past hurts, or people think they should, but it's hard to not be who you are in the moment with what you have. So there's this expectation and desire to be greater than yourself, to be your best self, to be some kind of transcendent being tuned in with this, you know, life-changing, in the biggest sense, event. And then we're still just the people that we are. So I think a lot of times having help from outsiders, whether it's hospice or a friend or any nurse who's dealt with death and dying, to help people prioritize and talk through some of the different things that have to be taken care of. And I have a bias that hospice is useful in that context when it's what people want, because we've seen this over and over again and have different people on the team that can help with each of these different areas and have already done some of the research. So everybody doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. You can just be given, here's how this works, here's how this works, here's how this works.
It was an enormous, like, unknown, everything from the disease to this kind of question. So I certainly would echo that. We're going to open the phones in just a minute, so get your dialing fingers out. The numbers are 510-848-4425 or 800-958-9008. And we particularly would like to talk to people who are in the end stages of their life or are taking care of people in the end stages. So I want to ask you one more thing, which is, I think about economics. Some people have this death at home, and I think it's pretty statistically known that that's what most people want at this point. But not everyone ends up that way. Not everyone can provide that for their loved ones. How does this break down? Who ends up being able to die at home? Who ends up in nursing care?
There's two answers to that, Adrian. One is that the same people that are at risk in most situations, gay and lesbian people, trans people, immigrants, poor people, people who are living in a community other than the one that they look like, all of those people are always at risk in our society, unfortunately, and are at the end of life. However, if you are over 65 or you're disabled and have Medicare, you have certain benefits. And if you have Medi-Cal additionally, at least for now, although we all know we're looming under all these impending budget cuts, the combination of Medi-Cal and Medicare can pay for someone to be in a nursing home, whereas Medicare alone or private insurance alone cannot. So depending on the kind of family you're from and the culture you're from, and whether it's a family of origin that you're still in connection with or a created family, you can be, you're best able to be taken care of at home when you have a large support network, whoever that is. And being taken care of in a facility is usually a second or third or fourth choice for people. But having a combination of Medicare and Medi-Cal gets you the most comprehensive coverage.
So let me give you the numbers again for people who'd like to call in. It's 510-848-4425 or 800-958-9008. And we're talking to Elaine McGee, longtime hospice nurse, about end-of-life issues. So the advanced directives that we were given by Kaiser, because my friend was a Kaiser member, they were pretty sophisticated. They really broke it down. Could you tell us some of the kinds of things that come up when you're, I mean, we all kind of know, I want to be turned off or want to be left on, that sort of basic thing, but it's actually very complicated.
It is. And for people, there's two different scenarios. If you have a life-threatening illness or a terminal illness, then there's something called a PULSED. And that's actually a doctor's order that goes in your record that makes it a medical order to only have the things done that you want. Many other kinds of advance directives state your wishes, but they're not a doctor's order that goes with you from any location, from the doctor's office to a facility, to a hospital. And it's complicated. It depends on the kind of illness you have. For instance, people who have dementia or something that affects their brain, and they may slowly lose the ability to recognize anyone else, lose the ability to swallow, lose the ability to walk. When you've lost the ability to swallow, in many scenarios, that could be considered a natural part of dying. You won't swallow nutrition, you won't swallow liquids, but sometimes people choose to put a feeding tube in someone who no longer can swallow, which could prolong their life for months. And that's something that many people feel, no, I absolutely don't want that. But if you don't write it down, it's not known. There's another point in life when you're having difficulty swallowing where you may inhale some of your food or even your own saliva and get pneumonia. Well, that could also be considered a very natural way of dying. Pneumonia used to be called the old man's friend, and that's what that is talking about. And now you have the option of having IV antibiotics, treating that pneumonia, getting over it so that you can swallow, inhale your spit and get pneumonia 3 days later. And then you could be treated with IV antibiotics, and the same thing could happen the next week.
And different people might want different things.
That's correct.
Totally.
And for some,
reasonable to want
that's
something
right.
different at this
some
point.
Some people would want treatment every single time, and that's important for them to make known, and other people wouldn't.
So we want to go to Karen in Oakland.
Yes, I would like to know for a person who's been diagnosed with fourth stage ovarian cancer, what is the best way to help support that person and to help the family members to understand, and in most cases none of us understand, and I was wondering if there necessarily is that a short-term life, or have people gone on and lived for years with that type of diagnosis?
Well, that's a pretty serious diagnosis, but the specifics of it are going to come from the practitioners that are treating that person.
Okay, and in terms of helping helping this person, like you're talking about things to be done in the event of death, what is the best way to help the other family members to do the things that need to be done? Is there an organization to contact?
If the practitioners say that the person's likely to be coming to the end of their life in 6 months to a year, then that's something that's considered hospice appropriate, and those are people who deal with end of life all the time. that may not be so, depending on what choices the person's making, if they're choosing some kind of treatment to prolong their life. Always a good place to start is to talk to the person with the illness and ask them if they want to talk about what they want. Ask family members or loved ones or caregivers. Start out by asking people what they want. And there's this kind of rule about meeting people where they're at. Like somebody will maybe say, I wonder if this means it's the end. And then if you're meeting them there, rather than saying yes or no, you say, wow, that's a big question. What do you think about that? So that they're leading the conversation with their willingness to discuss.
Well, that's very helpful. So an appropriate question to ask a practitioner is the expected term?
I would say, what do you expect? What do you see happening here? What's the treatment plan? How long do you think he, she, we, I have? Tell me what I can expect and what my options are.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Karen, and good luck with this. I know these are just the beginning of this journey for you. Georges is here from San Francisco.
Morning. I think there are different... I can't imagine that we haven't brought this up already, but it occurs to me, discussing this morning, that there are different ways that a person may come to the end of his or her life, where it's a progressive illness is one route, but if you fall off your ladder or get hit by the bus, as we say, or if something happens suddenly and a person is in intensive care, then what kind of provision is there for making an effort to turn it around? Can you actually state that you want to have a certain amount of time to rally and to see if you can be recovered, if you can be helped?
This is a great question, George. Let's get to it because we got someone else on the line.
Thank you.
Yes, that's why we said early on, do advance directives if you're 18 or you're 30 or you have no illness or you're 60. Just always have written down somewhere and talked about with your friends what you would want to do in the scenario that you're talking about.
Let's go to Becky in Berkeley, I believe.
This is Betsy from Berkeley.
Betsy, I'm sorry.
Hi, no problem. Thank you so much for this topic. And it's dear to my heart. I lost my 95-year-old dad last fall and was with him for 2 months. And during that time, hospice was right by our side and were just absolutely incredible. And I just felt like I wanted to say that hospice to us was not about the last days of life. It was about, fortunately for us, the last months of life, and during which hospice walked us through so many important things about how to be with someone who is facing the end of their life. And, you know, my dad thankfully had enough clarity of mind that he really was reviewing. He really was reassessing. And it wasn't conscious. He's not from the therapy generation. It wasn't that kind of thing. But he was reflecting. And one of the things that really stands out for me that I wanted to share with people is that at some points, you know, he would say he'd be in bed and he'd be kind of half asleep or whatever. And he said things like, I wasn't a very good dad to you kids. You know, I didn't pay enough attention to you when you were little. You know, he was having those regrets that we all have. And it, as a daughter, it was so tempting to want to say, oh, Dad, it's all right. Don't worry. You were great. You were a great dad, which wasn't the whole truth. It really wasn't. You know, he was right. He was right. And I didn't know what to say. And I talked to the hospice, one of the counselors, and she said, and we both felt like, don't take that away from him. You know, he is trying to make sense of his life, and he is trying to address some of the regrets and pain and loss and whatever. And I didn't want to take that away from him by kind of smoothing it over and sugarcoating it. But I also didn't want to say, yeah, Dad, you really were, you know, you were a lousy father, because that wasn't true either, you know. And so we were trying to find this middle ground of just saying, you know, thanks, I'm so glad you can share that with me. That must be hard to feel, and I love you so much, and we made it through. And another counselor said to my sister, who had the same question.
I'm going to cut you off, Betsy. Elaine, last comments here.
Sorry about that.
No, it's wonderful you called.
Thank you.
Yes, I just think that's a wonderful example of meeting somebody right where they are and not denying or affirming or fixing or changing, but just absolutely being present with the person where they are and letting them lead. That's a beautiful example of that.
Well, it's a great way to end this segment because I know there are listeners out there who are facing this end of their life or taking care of people, and it's difficult, but it's a very great project to help people face it with as little physical and emotional pain as possible. So I send every one of you my love. If you want to know more about My Roommate, you can check out the last couple of programs on Pushing Limits. Go to KPFA's website or the Pushing Limits website at pushinglimits.i94.net. And we'll be right back. Close today's Morning Mix with a look at an environmental issue. Most of us already know that the world's oceans are suffering from a number of human-created problems: oil spills, pollution by pesticides and fertilizer runoff, overfishing, and more. To that list, add another issue, one that might be as destructive as any of these I just mentioned: a change in the chemistry of the ocean water itself, with possible catastrophic effects on marine life. Tell us a little more about this, Anthony.
Adrian, what's happening, environmental groups say, is that the ocean is becoming more acidic, and the culprit is the increasing amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere caused by the burning of fossil fuels. So what will the consequences be for marine life and for human life? They could be calamitous. Joining us in the studio to discuss this topic is Emily Jeffers with the Center for Biological Diversity. Welcome, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
Now, many of us probably have some vague recollection of high school chemistry and the concept of pH. We remember, perhaps, that a solution with a pH of 7 is neutral, neither acid nor alkaline. Above 7 is alkaline, below 7 is acidic. The ocean itself is naturally somewhat alkaline. However, the pH of the ocean is dropping, moving more in the acid direction, and it's changing very rapidly by historical standards. Can you give us some background on that?
Sure. As you said, as we emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, about a third of that carbon dioxide is absorbed by our oceans. And that comes out to about 22 million tons of carbon dioxide every day that our oceans take up. As our oceans absorb this, they become more acidic. Since the start of the Industrial Revolution, the oceans have become about 30% more acidic. The baseline for most ocean waters is between about 8 and 8.3. And it's changed about 0.1 pH, but due to the pH scale, that corresponds to about a 30% increase in acidity.
Whoa. Excuse me, but that was shocking. That's such a small, tiny increase, statistically speaking, but it has, I guess, enormous consequences.
It does have enormous consequences. The last time that our ocean's pH changed this rapidly was about 55 million years ago, and at that time, 96% of all marine life died.
How are the changes of today apt to affect today's marine life?
Well, as our waters get more acidic, it becomes harder for the species that form shells out of calcium carbonate, like shellfish and corals and crabs, to form the shells that they need to survive, and it also makes those shells have a greater tendency to dissolve in the seawater. And that can have ripple effects on the whole food chain. For example, salmon, about 60% of juvenile salmon diet are tiny little creatures called pteropods, whose shells are becoming thinner and thinner due to ocean acidification.
So this isn't just theoretical or observed in laboratories. It's actually being observed in the oceans themselves.
It is being absorbed, not being absorbed. It's being observed, and I think the effects will become more apparent as this increases. But already we're seeing the effects.
Is it happening all over the world, or is it concentrated in certain regions?
It's happening all over the world. A couple years ago in the Pacific Northwest, oysters failed to reproduce, and that problem has only increased in scope. Recent surveys along the California coast have shown that all of the waters along California are becoming more corrosive and more acidic.
And what kinds of plants and animals in the ocean are most sensitive to a change in the pH?
The most sensitive, I think, are the tiny little plankton that form hard shells, and also corals. Corals are very sensitive, and coupled with increasing water temperatures, they are really getting hit hard. But I think these effects will really ripple throughout the food chain. For example, baleen whales, they eat krill, and krill are calcifying organisms that are impacted by ocean acidification. There's also all kinds of effects that I think we're only starting to understand. More acidic waters, the acoustic properties of the seawater changes, so sound travels farther. It becomes noisier, and animals that use sound to communicate, like dolphins and whales, are going to have a harder time.
10 minutes before 9 on KPFA Morning Mix, I'm Anthony Fest with Adrian Lobby. And we're talking to Emily Jeffers at the Center for Biological Diversity about acidification of the oceans. So, Emily, it sounds like this could be as great or greater than any of the other problems that are afflicting the ocean nowadays, such as oil spills or fertilizer runoff into the Gulf of Mexico or the Pacific garbage patch or you name it. This is worldwide.
I think you're right. I think there are a lot of threats to our ocean. Habitat destruction, overfishing, pollution, acidification, and altogether they are just becoming very difficult, I think, for the creatures in our oceans to survive and to thrive.
So we promised people a strategy to get us back from the brink. What can be done? And I know you wrote President Obama. It was a big deal to write the president. And what are you saying?
So our latest campaign, we're asking President Obama and EPA to make a national plan to protect marine life from ocean acidification. And you can learn more at endangeredoceans.org and to sign the petition. We've also been working with the EPA to try to get them to regulate acidification under the Clean Water Act. In 2009, as a result of a lawsuit and a settlement, EPA recognized that the Clean Water Act could be used to address acidification.
Now, indeed, your organization, the Center for Biological Diversity, has issued statements criticizing the EPA for not acknowledging the impact of acidification on U.S. coastal waters. But suppose the EPA does say, yeah, there's a problem here, but then what?
Well, I think you know, the solution is to reduce our carbon emissions, and that's a big ask. But I think it can be done, and I think if we start now, the oceans have a greater chance of surviving and thriving, and these creatures not going extinct.
So, what steps should be taken to actually begin addressing the problem, and not merely the EPA declaring that it sees there is a problem? What would be a good start?
Well, states can set their own water quality standards under the Clean Water Act, and we currently all states have standards for pH, but they're not really protective enough of the waters, and they don't recognize that small changes in pH really have huge ramifications for marine life. So we've been asking states to change their water quality standards and then to recognize when those standards aren't being met, that those states should declare those waters impaired and form a plan to reduce the carbon emissions from their states to reduce the impacts of acidification on their own waters.
But since it's a worldwide problem, that you really need the cooperation of all the large greenhouse gas emitters to improve the state of our waters, for example, just as we need the U.S. to reduce emissions, to improve the condition of Australia's waters, for example?
Sure. It's a worldwide problem, and I don't think that, you know, one state alone is going to fix it, but we need all the states together to fix it. And California, for example, is a huge emitter of carbon dioxide. So, and traditionally, California has been a leader in the environmental movement. And I think that if California, for example, took this step, other states would follow, and I think it would provide a good example for the rest of the country and the rest of the world on how to deal with the problem.
And finally, as we wrap up, in the context of this issue, doesn't it point up again the gap between scientific knowledge and politicians' positions? Some of them are still insisting that global warming isn't happening, or if it is, it's not connected to greenhouse gas emissions from human activities. Do you think there's ever been an issue where there's such a gulf between science on the one hand and political institutions on the other?
Well, for global warming, I think that's certainly true, and for ocean acidification even more so. Most people don't know what it is. Most people have heard of global warming and never heard of ocean acidification, so I think there's a real big a big hurdle for us to get over. We have to make sure people understand this and demand of their politicians that they act. And I think that if people understand what's happening to their oceans, they will become more involved and more, you know, they'll want to save the dolphins, they want to save the whales, and everyone loves the ocean.
And where would you suggest people go for more information?
I suggest you go to endangeredoceans.org to learn about our new campaign to protect marine life from ocean acidification and to sign our petition to President Obama.
Well, thank you, Emily Jeffers from the Center for Biological Diversity. A couple of announcements. Today in Richmond, Hoodie Up for Trayvon Martin. That starts at 11 a.m. on the corner of 7th and Barrett Avenue in the city of Richmond, and they will march to City Hall. There's going to be an open discussion of Marin County's General Assistance Program tomorrow night, Tuesday, at 6 p.m., hosted by the Marin Peace and Justice Coalition and the County Health and Human Services Department. This will be held at the Marin County of Education, 1111 Las Galeanas Avenue in San Rafael.
And tomorrow evening in Palo Alto, Ray McGovern, the former CIA analyst, will be speaking. His topic is the state of the National Security State, 2012. Ray McGovern speaking at the First Baptist Church, 305 North California Avenue in Palo Alto, beginning at 7:30.
And that concludes today's Morning Mix. I'm Adrienne Lobby, and I've been here with John for producing, and thanks to you for spending part of your morning with us. Please stay tuned for the 9 a.m. broadcast of Democracy Now! You can reach us at 510-848-6767, extension 639. We'd love to hear from you.
It's KPFA 94.1 Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 Berkeley, or KFCF 88.1 Fresno. Pacifica Radio for Northern and Central California. Thanks for joining us.
This is a listing of upcoming events in the Bay Area for the week ending April 22nd. All events are wheelchair accessible. Please listen closely for contact numbers. On Wednesday, April 18th at 7:30 p.m., you are invited to view Crude Independence. This low-key documentary captures the change in Stanley, North Dakota, after an historic 2006 oil discovery. $5 donations accepted. This film will be screened at the Humanist Hall, 390 27th Street, between Telegraph and Broadway in Oakland. For details, call 510-681-8699. On Sunday, April 22nd, from 10 a.m. to noon, there will be a film screening of Crisis in the Congo, Uncovering the Truth, followed by a discussion about the complex. This free event will be in the Oak Room at the Lafayette Oranda Presbyterian Church, 49 Knox Drive, in Lafayette. For details, call 925-283-8722. On Thursday, April 17th at noon, the Commonwealth Club presents Judge Vaughn Walker, retired Chief U.S. District Judge, speaking on the private law office. The event will be in the San Francisco Club office, Blue Room, 595 Market Street, 2nd floor. Tickets are $20, $12 for members, $7 for students. For details, call 415-597-6705. The community calendar is produced by members of the KPFA Apprenticeship Program. Send send your listing at least 3 weeks in advance to KPFA Box 51, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley, California, 94704, or email us at calendar@kpfa.org. Attention to the community calendar. Tell us if your event is wheelchair accessible. To hear this calendar again, call 510-848-6767, extension 621. This calendar is also online at kpfa.org.
The sociologist and psychotherapist Lillian Rubin says about Richard Lickman, "I have never met a more profound critical thinker or an intellect that runs deeper and wider." I'm not sure I have either. I'm C.S. Song, co-host of Against the Grain, inviting you to Richard Lickman's presentation, Cry the Corrupted Country, Reflections on the Psychopathology of Capitalism. This KPFA benefit happens Friday, May 11th at 7:30 at the very congenial Hillside Club in Berkeley, 2286 Cedar Street. It's wheelchair accessible. Lickman is a noted philosopher, social critic, and professor emeritus of psychology. Advanced tickets are $12 at independent bookstores or through brownpapertickets.com. At the door, tickets are $15. More information at kpfa.org.